This is an AMI podcast. This is an AMI podcast.
I'm Kelly McDonald. Here's a segment from our show, Kelly and Company, that airs weekdays from 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern on AMI Audio. When you want to check out, you know, maybe information about AMI, great place to do it is the Accessible Media Inc. Facebook page. You can like it. You can read lots of stuff on there, have some conversation, good videos and things like that to check it out. Just like the Accessible Media Inc. Facebook page. If you want to send a message, maybe you've got a question about AMI TV, AMI Tele, or AMI Audio, feedback at AMI.ca. That's feedback at AMI.ca. And, of course, Ramya can be reached on Twitter at AllRams with a Z. Myself, AMI Kelly Mack. Always like to chat. Ramya Muthan, my co-host in Toronto at the home studio. Kelly McDonald here at the home studio, London, Ontario.
Well, it's time for our Ask a Vet segment, and this is something we do on Tuesdays with our veterinarian, Danielle Jonkind.
The human-animal bond plays such an important role in people's lives, and as a veterinarian, it's my privilege to help keep those bonds strong and healthy. I'm Dr. Danielle Jonkind, and welcome to Ask a Veterinarian.
We put it out there to Kelly and Company contributors to chat climate change with us this week, Kels, and a lot of the contributors have brought this theme onto their segments, including Danielle. And Danielle, you're going to talk today about how climate change is affecting our animals, not just our pets, but about our farm animals and wildlife and how all of it is affected. You're also going to give us some tips for things that everyday people can do to help fix the problem. So, does the veterinary industry have many initiatives or programs going to combat climate change, Danielle?
Actually, not to my knowledge, unfortunately. I read a lot of periodicals related to the veterinary industry, and, you know, they come from our professional associations and from academic sources. And, you know, rarely, if ever, have I run across any articles geared toward encouraging veterinarians to join the fight against climate change as a group, you know, and, you know, even going onto websites for professional organizations and browsing the content there, you know, I can't really find much, if anything, related to the issue. So as an industry, so far, it looks like we have a lot of room for improvement there. And that isn't to say that individual veterinarians or veterinary practices haven't made some amazing progress in doing what they can for the benefit of the planet. But, you know, I think as an industry, we have a responsibility to do a lot more. I mean, our mandate is to maintain and promote the health and well-being of our patients and by extension, the public. And, you know, since planetary and ecosystem health directly impacts that well-being, you know, I feel like, you know, we should be jumping in with both feet to help that situation out.
So when we think about our pets, how does climate change affect them?
Well, you know, some of the impacts are what I call big picture impacts. And, right. You know, what I mean by that is that, you know, some of these impacts aren't felt immediately by most individuals. And of course, those are the hardest ones to see coming. And that makes them difficult to get people to care about them, right? So when I say big picture impacts, I mean things like extreme weather and natural disasters, you know, in other parts of the world. And, you know, sometimes it's hard to see how a natural disaster somewhere else will have implications for Canadian pets until you look backward at a chain of events. And I'm going to give you a very specific example here. And a good example can be found in that we know that climate change is causing an increase in the frequency and severity of extreme weather all over the world. And a lot of us probably remember when Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans in 2005, and it caused a lot of flooding and death and billions of dollars in damage to homes and infrastructure. And one of the tragic impacts of that event was that thousands of pets were abandoned or had suddenly become homeless. And, you know, a lot of pet rescue organizations stepped up and imported those pets to Canada in response, or some of them anyway, and thankfully finding some of those poor animals new homes. Unfortunately, a lot of pets in the southern U.S., you know, can possibly be infected with heartworm and with diseases carried by ticks. So not all of them would have been tested or treated for those issues before being brought here and adopted out to new homes. A study published in 2011 in the Journal of the American Veterinary Medical Association found that 74.4% of dogs and 92.9% of cats adopted from the Hurricane Katrina disaster had evidence of current or previous infection with diseases carried by ticks or mosquitoes. So, I mean, in theory, it's quite possible that some of these diseases could then have been introduced into new places when those pets were rehomed after the hurricane. So when you look at the big picture, you know, driving a big gas-guzzling luxury SUV could have contributed to a hurricane, which caused your neighbor to adopt a dog from New Orleans, which infected a mosquito with heartworm and was possibly the reason your own dog tested positive for that this year. Now, of course, that's a theoretical example, but, you know, it illustrates the principles of how our own actions can impact the health of our pets. And the fact is that, you know, our pets are now facing diseases related to climate change. When I was a new graduate and back in 1999, tick-borne diseases were not really anything I considered. I'd never even seen a tick on an animal. Now vets routinely test for these problems, and I see ticks on pets all the time. Our winters are less severe, and ticks are now able to survive them, which allows them to reproduce here and establish resident populations. And those ticks can now carry and transmit diseases that we never used to have here in the past. And this is directly impacting our health and the health of our pets.
Wow. That is actually really incredible to think, you know, even while you were going through school, some of this stuff just wasn't there. And now it's a thing. Like, I mean, I never even thought of the possibilities that dogs being able to transmit, you know, like bring ticks on is at one point wasn't even real. Wow. Okay. How about climate change impacting farm animals, Danielle?
Well, you know, farm animals are even more adversely impacted by things like severe storms and floods. I mean, with planning, you know, you can take your pets with you if you have to evacuate a natural disaster zone. So if you know this is likely and you plan ahead of time for what your plan is going to be if something bad happens to you, you know, you probably or may be able to take your pets with you. But, you know, large animals like herds of cows and herds of horses are, of course, infinitely more difficult to relocate and provide for if something like that happens. And that can result in a lot of unnecessary animal deaths. Another good example of how climate change is affecting farm animals comes from the Prairie provinces this past summer. Scientists have been predicting that droughts are going to become more frequent and more severe as the world warms. And the prairies had a record-breaking drought this year, and that decimated their pastures, their crops, and water supplies. And many Western farmers, according to the news, had no choice but to reduce or get rid of their herds by selling or slaughtering them. And, you know, they just didn't have enough food or water to keep them going at that size. And so that aspect of climate change has had a huge impact on farm animals. And, you know, I was reading in the news this past week that another what they call La Nina weather event is forming this year. And according to the article I was reading, those events tend to worsen drought conditions in the West. So, you know, that's going to have even more impact on those farms next year, I guess, or it possibly could anyway.
And so much to think about as we observe, we see, and what we think about a lot of time will catch us by surprise because, wow, like Rum said a while ago, I never thought about that. Let's talk about the wildlife out there.
Well, of course, you know, climate scientists and wildlife biologists have been sounding the alarm for years about habitat loss due to climate change and the resulting loss of the plants and animals that depend on those habitats. You know, the plight of the polar bear, you know, who relies on intact sea ice to hunt is a well-known example, since the Arctic is melting at an unprecedented rate. Another example would be the impacts of the increasing number and size of wildfires we're seeing. You know, so, I mean, we heard about them in BC this year and Northern Ontario. While some species, of course, will benefit from the fires going through, others, like some of the larger apex predators, these animals require large tracts of intact forest to survive. And, you know, as more and more of the forest burns every year, that puts the populations of those wild animals at risk because there just aren't enough resources to support them. So, you know, there are a lot of impacts to be felt, you know, with the wildlife and, you know, and how everything out there is changing and what is able to live and what is not able to live based on, you know, how things are changing. So those impacts are definitely worth thinking about, you know.
Yeah, absolutely, Danielle. And speaking of that and the kind of examples that you've given today so far, that we're all thinking, wow, I never even considered this. What can people do in our everyday lives to combat climate change?
Well, it's interesting, you know, because I belong to a community group that, you know, works to educate and advocate for changes that will improve the climate change situation. And, you know, when we're out and doing events before the pandemic, one of the things that, you know, I heard from a lot of people who attended those events is almost like a kind of hopelessness, you know. It's kind of like we get the impression that the issue is too big for us to tackle. So, right. You know, a lot of people either they give up or they just ignore it, you know, kind of stick your head in the sand, you know, or a lot of people will advocate for someone else, you know, for example, the government to do something about it. And, you know, certainly government and societal action has to be a component of any successful strategy to deal with climate change. But I think that the other side of the coin is that there is lots the average person can do to help as well, you know, and I have a few suggestions because, you know, we all hear about the big situation. Suggestions, you know, like driving an electric car, that kind of thing. But, you know, really, you know, some of these suggestions are just out of reach for the average person. And that was one of the things that we got talking about in our climate change group was that, you know, a lot of the suggestions in the films we were showing and stuff were like, go out and buy a farm and, you know, grow organically. Well, that's just not reasonable for everybody, right? So, you know, there are a few things that everybody can kind of do. And, you know, one of the suggestions I have is every time you buy something, consider it almost like voting, you know, so remember that consumer demand drives the availability of what businesses will sell. So, you know, pay attention to what you buy. There's a lot of fossil fuel burning that goes into things like manufacturing, transporting, and packaging products that are for sale. So some guidelines to consider, you know, is first of all, do you really need that product? I mean, we're all kind of victims of advertising and of consumerism, right? So sometimes it's better to buy something used or it's better to repair something you already have. You know, can you make do with something else or do you really need that new thing? If you do decide that you need it or you really want it, because we're all not perfect here. I mean, we all sometimes want things we know we shouldn't have. But, you know, if you decide that you are going to buy it, consider buying products that are produced as locally as possible. Also consider buying products that are packaged as minimally as possible. And consider what will happen to that product when it can no longer serve its original purpose. You know, can it actually be recycled or reused for something else? Is it compostable or will it sit in landfill for 1,000 years? You know, every time I look at the toys that, you know, my kids have gotten for Christmas and stuff when they were little and, you know, now they're older and it's time to get rid of them. And I think, oh, what was I thinking? You know, so thinking about what you buy is really important.
Yeah, it's really now you think, and we know as we move through life, and like you say, Danielle, we're going to make those mistakes as we go. And one day we're going to do something. Another day we say, well, why did I grab that plastic bag? I need reusables instead. And that little bit helps so much with some of the big pictures that you're talking about. If we all do that one or two little things a week, a day.
Exactly, you know, and another thing that you can think about is what you eat. You know, again, a lot of fossil fuels are burned in the manufacturing, transportation, and packaging of processed foods. And, you know, even fresh foods are not totally innocent, particularly if they come from a far distant place and have to be shipped here. You know, also, cheap mass-produced food grown by industrial agriculture, you know, can contribute to the release of carbon stores from the soil. It can contribute to the loss of topsoil and the loss of nutrients from soil. And we also see with a lot of industrial agriculture, a lot of fertilizers, pesticides, and herbicides leaching into the water. So, you know, buying fresh foods from a local grower at a farmer's market is a good step in the right direction, especially if they practice something called regenerative farming. Regenerative farming actually sequesters carbon in the soil. It retains topsoil and doesn't rely on the use of herbicides, pesticides, and fertilizers. And so, you know, it's worth supporting farmers that are growing food that way. So, you know, ask some questions about what you're buying and, you know, go from there.
For sure, Danielle. Thanks for covering so much for us to kick off the show. We appreciate it. Talk to you next week.
Okay. Have a good week.
Danielle Jeankind, she's our veterinarian who joins us on Tuesdays.
We're going to carry on the conversation of those little things we can all do during our wellness segment as Francis Wong joins us next.
You've been listening to Kelly and Company. If you're hooked, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast platform. And be sure to leave us a rating and review. Or you can listen live from 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern on AMI Audio.
This was an AMI podcast. For more accessible media, visit AMI.ca.